Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
I mean, what's that football focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFF.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
And you just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, Sam.
So,
who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football. I like football season and all the things that go with it.
Welcome into the PFF NFL podcast. Steve Palazzolo back here with Sam Monson and a very special guest, Ian Harditz from PFF. It is our number one fantasy analyst, number one in my heart, at least, here at PFF. So it's a new show. It's a new deal, extra show every week.
Why did we come in dressed the same?
I don't know.
Hmm.
I tried to mix it up.
Yeah?
So what happened was I've got I don't know if our viewers have noticed, but I've got a rotation of like four collared shirts that I use. So now it's like, oh, we're up in the ante. We've got an extra show per week. It's on Wednesdays now. Here we are. And I was like, I gotta
dip into the t-shirts.
I had to go into the pocketed 1995 t-shirt here that I have.
Okay.
I'm impressed you guys can live with the t-shirts in this igloo of an office we have, which makes it much tougher because it's humid as hell outside.
Right. That's the problem, right? Is that you can have one or the other. No outfit that functions for both the outside and in the studio for any extended period of time.
You just gotta go. Thermostat's over there. You just go manipulate it a
little
bit.
You said no outfit, but have we tried a sleeveless hoodie? If it works for Belichick, I mean.
No. I haven't rocked that for either, but yeah, maybe.
I'm willing to take a look at that in the future.
I'm just saying this is starting to get PFF. A little bit concerning. Like between this and the fact that we both came up with the same random number for the absurd hyperbole Corey Davis target number of the season.
Yeah, we both in isolation made a Corey Davis joke that he was on pace for 900 targets this year. We both came up with the number 900. I tweeted it, and then he texted me the same number. I was like, what, are you just mocking my tweet? He goes, no, this is – I hadn't even seen that.
I think I tweeted 250 in my mock.
There you go.
Everyone's happy.
I'm just starting
we'll talk about Corey Davis here.
A little bit concerned that we're blending into the same person now.
So, big show. First off, like I said, PFF NFL podcast, we're adding a third show. So, during the season, you'll still get your review podcast, your preview podcast, but the midweek podcast – is going to be a great way for us to get some other people here from PFF to just talk ball and mm-hmm. Talk about whatever their particular expertise is. And in Ian's case, it is fantasy football. It is fantasy football draft season. DFS is always alive. All of that stuff. So we could talk about all of that through the lens of just a good football discussion.
And you can hear him on the PFF Fantasy Football Podcast. There are other podcasts outside of us, Steve. At PFF. I know it's hard to believe, but they exist.
As the big show here at PFF, we're here to promote. We're here to promote everybody else and to push them.
Yes, exactly. One last piece of housekeeping before we actually start the podcast. We passed $2,000, our goal.
In five days.
Right. You will. Bills Mafia are there when it comes to charity drives and giving money to a good cause. So you will be wearing a Josh Allen jersey, signing the Josh Allen apology form.
And that's it.
At some point soon. However.
No, that's it.
Hold you... on. Guaranteed a sum of money that if
didn't
we reach,
guarantee anything,
I have text proof that if we clear $10,000, you will be thrown through a table after doing this.
Not thrown through
flaming
a table,
or regular table?
Regular table, I think.
A working table.
Can
a
we go flaming for 15?
No flaming table.
It's up to him. He's the guy setting the prices.
You might get kicked off the show here in a minute.
So Bills Mafia, you guys have come up amazing so far with the donations. We're a fifth of the way there already. If we can get to 10K, a 6'10", 280-ish pound human will be launched through a table wearing a Josh Allen jersey after signing the apology form. And frankly, who doesn't want to see that?
A very astute listener did point out, as a creeping back toward middle age, older guy, big guy with some back problems and four kids, maybe this isn't the best idea. That maybe we don't need to push it.
Maybe not for you, but for everybody else.
Well, thanks to everybody for donating. Thanks to Bills Mafia, mostly, because I think they did most of the dirty work. So I will be signing the Josh Allen apology form, wearing the jersey. I got to order a jersey. Mm-hmm. Josh Allen, and we'll see if you get to the stretch goal, and we'll consider.
10K.
Heroes get remembered, legends never die.
The table bump. Somebody wants the picture of me flying through the air.
Hell yeah. If you're, well, the meme guy, the PFF podcast meme guy, it's currently me in the idiot Steve getup. So frankly, it needs to be replaced with you flying headlong through a table. So look, Bills Mafia, put it out there. Get it shared. Find the rich people. Find the people with lots of money at Bills Mafia and get them donating, because that's what we need.
Like Thurman Thomas or something. Call Thurman. Call Andre Reed.
Call Josh Allen. He's got some money now.
True. Maybe Josh Allen would want to see me go through a table. Ian does great work over at PFF.com. So now's a great time if you don't have access. Kickoff 30. We have 30% off any PFF subscription. Kickoff 30. So you get your 30% off. You can read all of Ian's work. You can get access to all of PFF's fantasy tools for just $7. So let's get into the discussion. I have a general question about fantasy and how it's just evolved over the last few years. How have strategies evolved? Is there, because I want to talk about the football aspect of it, but the strategy aspect of fantasy football, where is it right now here in 2021?
Couple easy notes. I mean, first of all, we have like two cheat codes that we can kind of try to draft. Rushing quarterbacks, receiving running backs. That's why, you know, when Najee Harris gets drafted and Eric's in my ear about how bad the O-line is and how bad the offense is and all this, if we have a running back that catches passes, it's so hard for them to bust. Christian McCaffrey was pretty mediocre as a rookie, was averaging like 3.5 yards per carry, was not living up to expectations. He was still a top 10 fantasy running back, because when you catch that many passes, it's just hard to bust. Same thing with the rushing quarterbacks. It's why Jalen Hurts, someone that was maybe the worst passer in the league last year, is a top 10 fantasy quarterback, because he was also on pace to break the single season rush attempt record at the position. So target the dual threat guys. You know, nowadays more than ever, I think you can get your starting running back, but after that, go heavy with the wide receivers. We just see all the injuries and just the lack of workhorses these days. In the year 2000, we had 19 running backs get at least 300 touches. Last year, 4. So it's a different game, and you can get your, you know, your CMC, your Cook, your Henry early, but after that, give me all those receivers that we can more respectfully project for 120 plus targets. And then last thing I just note is we have had Travis Kelce, George Kittle, and now Darren Waller just take over that tight end position. And every year we talk ourselves into some late round guys, Adam Trautman, Anthony Firkser, whoever it might be. And then by the time August comes around, we realize, terrible idea. I wish I had one of those top tight ends. So try to get one of those top three guys the best you can. Maybe get that anchor RB. And from there, load up on the dope wide receivers.
A huge amount of fantasy is nailing those studs. But then you've got like the breakout guys. The guys are actually going to win leagues for you because you're the one that has them and nobody else saw it coming. Who are some of the biggest breakout players you see coming this year? And let's talk about like why each one of those guys is going to break out.
Yeah, I mentioned Hurts at first, but it's just that the rush attempts. And honestly, as bad as his numbers were, PFF passing grade, I think he had the single worst adjusted completion rate in the league. The guy still threw for 300 yards in 2 games. I mean, Josh Allen couldn't say that until last year after his first 2 years of career. So
I mean, they're going to run him, and they might be playing from behind quite a bit. So it's this combination, right? Like he's going to have opportunities.
We don't care about style points. However the yards come, I mean, we'll take them there. And
the backup is Joe Flacco. So it's not like there's any real incentive to at any point in the season take him out. Like even if he plays badly, what do you gain from putting Joe Flacco in there? Particularly for the Eagles who, like in a way, the worse Jalen Hurts plays, the better it is for them in the offseason, right? Like they have zero incentive to ever make a switch if Jalen Hurts is playing badly this season.
I think some of the Watson rumors might have gotten people off the scent a little bit, but earlier in the offseason, Jalen Hurts was like a top eight fantasy QB because everyone was all in on the rushing. Now he's finally available in those later rounds. So I always say it, we don't hate players, we hate their average draft position, their ADP. I think Jalen Hurts is a good example. With wide receiver too, I think Diontae Johnson is someone who isn't going cheap, but people just look at the drops. Yeah. And as we see, you know, I know you're one of the bigger Jerry Jeudy stands out there. Usually raw drop totals just tend to tell you someone that gets open more than someone that's actually bad at football. So I wish Diontae didn't drop as many balls, but also like we're penalizing him for this, where if we look at the last 2 years, we see DK Metcalf, Tyreek Hill, Michael Gallup, all these other guys that are not getting, you know, discounted because of the drop issues. I know Pittsburgh's gonna be running a slightly different offense, but with that said, we're still looking at their undisputed number one that I think can push for 150 targets. He's not being ranked that way.
I think he'll be the volume guy. I keep saying I think Chase Claypool is the most important player for the Steelers, because he had flashes of that true number one. And they had a few games where they fed him. But Diontae Johnson's definitely the high-volume type of guy, right? And I think both of them together, as much as we haven't loved the Steelers' team-building process here, they changed the arithmetic there, right? If those guys are legit and Big Ben is better, the Steelers can be legit.
And the other thing about drops is that, like, there aren't that many guys that are consistently terrible when it comes to dropping passes. Like there are a few of them, you know, Braylon Edwards.
They're usually out of the league. Like Greg Little just doesn't last, right? If they can't
catch. But the other thing is the ones that have bad hands, you know, relatively bad hands compared with people like Larry Fitzgerald or whatever, those are the guys that just, it fluctuates, right? So you're going to have a year where you drop like 18 passes and it's catastrophic and everyone's like wringing their hands over. But the next year you'll drop like six, right? Which is still not great, but it's fine. Like, it's not a problem, particularly if you are really good at everything else, like getting open and, you know, racking up the yardage. So, like, one of those years where a guy like Diontae Johnson has a catastrophic number of drops, or Jerry Jeudy or whoever it is, I think it's just sort of, that's something to be aware of as the guy's floor. Yeah. It's not like this is where he's going to be every single year. Like, next year he's probably going to bounce back, have half the number of drops, and you can add, you know, 200-300 yards to his total because of it.
That's what I looked at. I was like, okay, let's look at the pass drop leaderboards, and is this a sign of bad things to come? No. I got to 2012, and last year we had Diontae, Jeudy, DK Metcalf, guys with double-digit drops. Just a few guys in 2012 that had at least 10 drops. Jimmy Graham, Wes Walker, Calvin Johnson, Eric Decker, Brandon Marshall, Dez Bryant, Demaryius Thomas, T.Y. Hilton, Stevie Johnson.
It's like, good group.
Imagine fading those guys because they dropped too many passes in 1 year. Couldn't be me.
Now, part of it's our fault at PFF, because the PFF grade is grading your production and what you did on the field. But the value of the PFF grade is identifying what happened and then identifying the things that you would focus on looking forward. And I think that's the bottom line, right? When you evaluate how well a guy played, whether it's Jeudy and all his drops last year or Diontae Johnson, you have to say he did a poor job of catching the ball at a high rate. So therefore, it's going to affect the grade. But that's where like the stable measures and unstable measures come in. And I think the bottom line for receivers, the skill of getting open is far more stable in the thing to focus on, whereas the skill of catching the ball, just yes or no, did you catch it, does just tend to fluctuate.
And there's also an aspect of like, was it that big a problem that your team is going to go away from you because of it? Because that's where you get into the Greg Little issue, right? Now, okay, Greg Little wasn't great at anything else either, but the issue there was the team very quickly went, okay, you're so bad at catching the ball, you're no longer this sort of viable number one option for us. It's not worth the time or the effort or the risk we put in to sending the ball your way. But that's not going to be the case, certainly for Jerry Jeudy in Denver, right? There's too much invested in him. He's too good at getting open. They're not going to look at those drops and say, the juice isn't worth the squeeze here. Same thing's true with Pittsburgh at Diontae Johnson. Even if the drops stay at the same level, which they probably won't, he's still going to get a ton of volume. He's still going to get the production.
Love it.
Absolutely.
Who else you got? Anybody else from a breakout player standpoint? A
couple Dolphins receivers. One adage I like to point out is, you know, we want to take guys closer to their floors than their ceilings. You know, last year, Clyde Edwards-Helaire busted on everyone because he was drafted as the fourth running back. And, you know, even though he finished top 20 when he picked him fourth, obviously, you know, he needed to really have a great season to come through with that. Will Fuller and Jaylen Waddle are going outside the top 40 receivers in fantasy right now. Fuller, before he got suspended last year, was a top 12 guy. Jaylen Waddle, number 6 overall pick. And for some reason, he's just been completely shafted behind Devontae and Ja'Marr Chase. So I get it. You know, confusing pecking order with Tua. I don't think it's the highest upside passing game in the league. But when we can draft these guys, again, just at their floor, I mean, it wouldn't surprise anyone if both Fuller and Waddle can turn in top 20 seasons. We can get them at basically half that cost. So Waddle's been the really interesting one to me. There was a report on like August 3rd, Waddle goes up for a catch in practice, comes down hard, and the person said he took an extra minute to get up, resume practicing, but made the point like, hey, can't afford an injury right now. I mean, no one can afford an injury like whenever. Like, what the hell does that have to do with anything? He's been one of the best players at Dolphins camp, and it's almost like people think he walks with a limp. From what I can tell, man, like, he's always just kind of walked that way. Some guys are just a little bit swaggier than others. So for me, like, to see the discrepancy between Devontae Smith, Ja'Marr Chase, and Jaylen Waddle, I understand everyone had Chase high as the top-rated receiver coming out. That's fair. A lot of people, I think, had Waddle ahead of Devontae, or at least in that same tier, pretty close. They're in a similar position in terms of projected targets. I think everyone's sleeping on the number 6 overall pick, which is crazy to me.
How do you think the Dolphins are going to use him? Because that, to me, is an interesting sort of difference between the other two.
That's the discrepancy, right? I mean,
yeah.
I think one guy's perceived as a low-volume deep threat. Devontae and Ja'Marr Chase are like, oh, those guys are number one.
Or even if it's not a low-volume deep threat, it's a sort of almost a pure slot guy or a gimmick receiver.
It's the Lynn Bowden role.
Like, whereas Devontae Smith is clearly talked about already as being Philadelphia's best wide receiver, right? Yeah. They're going to line him up wide. They're going to give him all. He's going to be the number one, right? Ja'Marr Chase, the same thing in Cincinnati if he ever stops dropping the ball in preseason. But with Waddle, it's a lot more up in the air. Like, what is his role to be better than these guys? And that was always my question at draft time, because you're right, there were a ton of people that had Waddle as the better Alabama receiver, which to me was madness, because the track record of Devontae Smith versus Jaylen Waddle, I think, was night and day. Yeah. And even the people saying, well, when they were both there for the 4.5 games or whatever it was this season, Waddle was getting more production. I mean, I don't think that was ever quite true. But now when you look at it projected forward, they certainly don't look to be projected for the same role. And that's going to affect the production, even if you think he's a better player.
Yeah, and you're not wrong. That's why Devontae Smith is going 20 wide receiver spots ahead of Waddle. Again, though, it's just the idea for me that you can treat Waddle as a wide receiver 4 in Fantasyland when we don't know his role, but he's going to be starting in 3 wide receiver sets. Again, buying the guy at the floor or ceiling. Like, I think even if he's the number 3 pass game option there, he could still finish with his value as a wide receiver 48. So certainly, you know, guys, Devontae Waddle, I get it. It'll all be cleared up, you know, next year in the future. Dynasty people don't have these problems. I'm just saying, redraft, man, more than ever with these, I just think we don't always see it. There's a John Ross bust situation. But if you take someone 6th overall, I'd like to think you have a plan for him. That's why everyone's so high on Kyle Pitts. Could he start the season behind Hayden Hurst? I really hope not, but I guess it's possible. But we assume that they're not going to do that because he just took the guy 4th.
They will feed those guys. Yeah. Absolutely. And you mentioned – go ahead, Sam.
Well, the other thing with Waddle is that even if he gets pegged as this, like, slot guy who gets the occasional deep target and whatever, with the way Tua is right now, that might actually be a really important thing for his production, right? Because
– he might be feeding the slot.
That's what I mean. He's going to be feeding the slot. He's going to be feeding the tight ends. The one to worry about would be the outside receivers, where he hasn't yet shown – the kind of propensity and the guts, I guess, to push the ball consistently down the field.
That's where I'd be a little scared of Devontae Parker, a guy that doesn't separate as well as the other guys and benefited from Yolo Fitzpatrick throwing him the ball. Mm-hmm. I do want to talk Dynasty in a minute. Before we get into that, though, I've got to give a shout-out to our friends over at Fantrax. Fantrax is free. Fantasy Football League Manager is the most customizable, easy-to-use, and feature-rich platform in the entire industry. And PFF is gearing up to play our leagues on Fantrax this year. Bonus points for touchdowns of different yardage, the multi-team trades, and of course, importing your league from another site. It's all at Fantrax. So you can create a free account now using promo code PFF at fantrax.com/PFF and get a chance to win a trip to any regular season game this year for you and your entire league, plus $6,000. Promo code PFF at fantrax.com/PFF. You mentioned Dynasty, and I don't know why you're the fantasy expert, because I'm kind of dominant in Dynasty. Mm. We have an experts league. I don't know why you weren't invited, but it was an experts league that started about 5 years ago. I've won 3 out of the 5 years.
Oh,
in the 2 years I kind of lost in the finals, the other two. all of the experts have fled. They left the experts league. So I'm not even going to ask your advice on Dynasty because I got it.
Okay.
I nailed it. But no, are there any... my advice on... I'll give you my advice. Draft really well. Even though it's a long-term league.
Wow.
Draft really well. If you draft well...
Huh. Big talk.
It almost doesn't even matter if you, you know, draft good college players in the future.
Yeah. So
there's my advice.
So that's great. I mean, let's...
Do you have any... how much do you handle looking at redraft versus Dynasty versus... You know, best ball is huge now. Yeah. Like, how do those? Obviously, dynasty versus redraft is a pretty clear distinction. What about like best ball strategies versus other fantasy strategies?
Best ball. I would say, you know, a lot of times when people are doing that, we're entering this like $1 million tournament where you're not just trying to beat 10 of your friends; you're trying to beat hundreds of thousands of entries. So that's when you can get really contrarian, and we can talk about these different strategies where we have people posting their lineups where Ronald freaking Jones is the first running back drafted, and they're almost pointing this out like as a sense of pride. And if you looked at that from a redraft standpoint, you'd be like, "What the hell?"
You almost
is that
have
lineup?
To have like a ridiculous team in order to have any shot of winning those.
Exactly.
It's like that draft that we got conscripted into with Chris, where it's the idea is to draft the worst possible team, the team like with the lowest number of points at the end of the season wins.
Yeah.
You almost need that for a best ball because that's the only way you're going to win versus a million people is if you hit the absurd combination of like injury luck, randoms coming out of nowhere, you know, the James Robinsons of the world. Like if you hit the sequence of 12 of those guys that works out and gives you this great team.
I have a question. The mental part of drafting, okay? Because when we were doing that worst ball draft, which you can hear all about on the Chris Collinsworth podcast this week, how much can you play mental games with yourself? Because when I'm drafting players for normal leagues or for worst ball, I'm sitting here picturing the scenario where like the best case happens and then the worst case scenario as well. Like I'm picturing these things. So like Melvin Gordon, right? I could draft him in both of those leagues. You could draft him in, you know, a normal league where it's like, yeah, he's a 20 carry guy and he'll hold off Javonte Williams. And then in the worst ball league, you're like, oh, they just drafted a guy and they traded up to go get Javonte Williams. He's going to get benched. How much does that play in where you're picturing either the good or a bad for a player and it influences maybe whatever your rankings were, whatever your initial feelings were?
For the best balls, like you want to look at that best case scenario and almost just assume your entire team is going to have that best case scenario. So some of the things that go along with that, you don't handcuff your running back. If I draft Ezekiel Elliott in round one, I don't take Tony Pollard in round 11 because in no way are both of those picks hitting. I'd rather have Zeke and then Alexander Mattison because then maybe Zeke hits, maybe Dalvin gets hurt, best of both worlds. So that's one factor.
Not that we're rooting for injuries here.
Never, except
not unless you're playing worst ball. Which case, that's what you're cheering for all season long.
But yeah, just really, again, just trying to go for that first or last approach. You know, like Rookie Bobby said, once upon a time, because you know we're not getting any sort of points for finishing in the middle of these leagues. So yeah, just optimizing as much as possible and trying to hit it big, I think, is where you can go. And that's where, you know, I was saying, like, try to draft closer to floor than ceiling. So when you see guys like Corey Davis and Brandon Cooks down the way, and they're just surrounded by a bunch of number three receivers, it's like, well, we can get the number one pass game option there. It might not be sexy, but it's, you know, probably more worthwhile to take a chance on Corey Davis versus a Michael Gallup, who, hey, you know, great receiver in his own right, don't have that same upside. Guys like James White, Giovanni Bernard, Nyheim Hines, they're okay in redraft. They can give you that floor and you can mix in floor and upside. But like Giovanni Bernard, Rojo, Fournette, like Keyshawn Vaughn could all get hurt and he still very well could be a part of a committee. So again, just all upside. What's the worst case scenario for the team and how could this guy benefit from it?
Corey Davis, I think, is a good guy to talk about because we're in preseason right now and we've gone, you know, months with no football whatsoever. So preseason happens and it's something, right? It's something to talk about. It's something to overreact to. And we did the overreaction show on Monday. But Corey Davis, you know, signs the reasonable free agent contract. But I think everyone was still looking at that and going, okay, you know, he'll probably be the number one receiver there, but that's not the same as being a number one, you know, somewhere where you know you have a star receiver. Yeah. So it's still going to look like sort of an important part of some kind of well-balanced, revamped receiving core in New York. Then we get to preseason, and Corey Davis is getting a target like 80% of the snaps he's on the field, right? Like every time it's possible
I told you.
For Zach Wilson to throw the ball to Corey Davis, he's doing it. So my question is, like, how much does preseason actually change your outlook on some of these things versus, because it's one of the big things, right, is how much does preseason matter, right? And for obviously wins and losses, not at all.
Yeah.
even projecting like performance into the regular season, not that much according to the data. But how much do things like that change your perception on what a guy is going to be?
The actual performance matters almost very little. As much as I love watching Felipe Franks like rip off a 50-yard run in the third quarter, like, no, that doesn't actually matter for fantasy. It's mostly the first team snap rates, because those, in my opinion, are far more valuable than whatever PR intern put out their depth chart in the first week of August. So I'm certainly taking the first team snaps ahead of, again, those online depth charts we see. And I think we've had some very real takeaways. The Corey Davis 13 routes, 10 targets, absolutely absurd. And he's someone that was going, you know, just more cheap than these should be, so people are now more aware of that. The Rondale Moore usage, I think he's played 45 offensive snaps, 8 targets, 3 carries. I was worried they were going to try to pigeonhole him into like an Andy Isabella role. No, yeah. They're using him like the way he should be used.
And
so,
critically, no longer rocking number 85.
Huge, that is huge.
Huge.
Understood that was a bad look, got rid of it. Now number 4.
Oh my God.
One of the only wide receivers I've seen that I didn't want to wear a number in the 80s.
It's unbelievable. Well, all the data that we collect,
I like
there it. Is no... Cornerbacks can't overcome a number in the 40s.
No.
And Rondale is not going to overcome.
Wait, Marlon Humphrey.
We got one.
One.
Yeah, but he's almost like a linebacker, the way they use him.
But I almost liked the idea. The number in the 80s is good conceptually, but somehow 85 on Rondale was just wrong. It just didn't work. And he understood that. That's self-awareness. That's push him up the draft board.
Yeah. Higher ADP there.
But so like one example of just really knowing what to look at and what not to. Javonte Williams. I mean, that first game he was throwing around Vikings defenders like they weren't even there. We know he's a great tackle breaker. I think he set our PFF record for highest, beat out Dave Montgomery for the college record. He was also splitting time at Royce Freeman with the first team in that. Like if Melvin Gordon wasn't even there. We know he's going to be the starter. Now maybe it's a 3-back committee. Got to pump the brakes a little bit on Javonte. But yeah, so like, you know, when I see Chuba Hubbard playing 27 of 28 first team snaps, now I feel good about putting him in more of a Mike Davis handcuff role. So, you know, don't change every single thing we've thought of from, you know, March to July every year. But again, just the usage and kind of figuring out what the depth chart pecking order is by far the most important part of the preseason.
It took 5 years. But Corey Davis, I mean, this is what I envisioned.
Well, if he gets a target on 77% of his routes during the regular season, he'll definitely be on course to the Hall of Fame at that point.
I envisioned a high volume, you know, Uber plus possession type for Marcus Mariota 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And maybe it was for Zach Wilson.
And then you were ready to be out, and then he toasts Stephon Gilmore, and you're like, I'm back. Yeah. And then you're
it. Here's the weirdest thing about Corey Davis. There's a few players whose playing style when they got to the NFL just didn't match what I anticipated. Andrew Luck was actually one of these guys. I anticipated Andrew Luck to be a Peyton Manning, Tom Brady, Drew Brees, get rid of the ball quickly and win with his brain type of player. And he was closer to Big Ben, where he just kind of like sat back there, took all these hits, blamed the offensive line, and made spectacular plays. Playing style was completely different. Corey Davis became this like contested catch, you know, spectacular catch type of guy. When I'm like, oh, I thought he was just going to get open a lot and be your high volume Z receiver. So every now and again, I think I'm just off, obviously, on playing style. But you see a guy that plays in the NFL, I think, differently than they did in college.
I ran the numbers just for giggles when I was writing the article about Corey Davis. If he matched the number of routes from last year in a low volume Titans passing attack this season with the Jets and maintained the 77% target rate, he would get something like 236 targets of the year.
236 targets might be valuable.
Yeah,
it was crazy last year. I mean, PFF receiving grade, yards per catch, yards after the catch, yards per route run. Corey Davis and Julio Jones were basically the same person. Now, I know one of them is striking far more fear in opposing secondaries than the other, but, you know, hey, players can get better over time. It's legal in 2021.
But even the point I would make, I would explain that away, too. Yeah. As much as I was a Corey Davis fan 5 years ago and expected him to be a high-volume guy, it's like, okay, play action, heavy attack. You've got A.J. Brown on the other side.
Yeah.
Corey Davis, I think, has settled in as a good number two. You know, a good guy that you put outside and he can win at the intermediate level.
The A.J. Brown thing, I think, is the big question. It's like, okay, you break out once teams are suddenly concerning themselves with like a legitimate, fearsome number one on the other side. What does that look like now in New York when you're the guy, right? Where there's no, like, unless Elijah Moore is way better than people are expecting him to be, unless Denzel Mims comes back from the darkness, from the wilderness and shows up as that number two, unless all the attention goes to the middle of the field. Like, Corey Davis is going to have to deal with a lot more attention than he did a year ago.
Can we get Mims to New Orleans or somewhere?
Anywhere.
Like, come on.
God.
How about Marcos Callaway, by the way? Yeah. Also on my championship dynasty team, by the way. But how about, I mean, he looks like a true number one right now. I'm all in on Callaway.
Well, and he's not beating scrubs. He beat freaking Shaq Griffin. I think he got Marlon Humphrey the week before. Like, that's another thing we're seeing.
Just beating them, but like the way, like the first one, he caught the ball essentially after taking a full speed shoulder check. And the second one, like Shaq Griffin had one of his arms pinned, so he just caught it one-handed with his left hand for a touchdown. Like, those are insane catches, not just the fact that he was open in the first place.
It's not Ramondre Stevenson running away from a bunch of, you know, future grocery
bags. Right.
91-yard run for Stevenson, but he's also looked good. Of course, the NFL's back. That's what we're talking about here. DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL, is giving away, for all new players, a can't-miss offer for week one. Bet just $1 on any NFL game during the first week of the season and receive $200 in free bets instantly, no matter what. Take advantage of this limited-time offer now. Head to DraftKings Sportsbook app now. Check out all the great promotions and daily odds boosts. Plus, you can make every game a big game with same-game parlays. So right now, download the DraftKings Sportsbook app. Use the promo code PFF to receive $200 in free bets when you place a $1 bet on any week one game. That's it. Promo code PFF to get your free $200 bets. $200 in free bets instantly for a limited time, only at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. And of course, Ian, you must be 21 or older, New Jersey, Indiana, or Pennsylvania only. New customers only. New restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for details. Gambling problem, call 1-800-GAMBLER or in Indiana, 1-800-9-WITH-IT. Almost lost it there.
A little stumble in the middle there.
Do you need a terms and conditions guy for your
podcast? I thought I was good at that, and then now I feel bad.
Okay, myself, I haven't seen your work. I've seen George's work. Uh-huh. I think George set the standard here, which is why we still use him here at Western and Southern.
Well, that's why all the external ones go. It's George's terms and conditions.
Yeah, George is really good. I've been working on my game here.
Yeah.
Or you can be the person that, you know, names all the side effects.
Yes.
Like on the side effects
NFL commercial.
Do you remember Micro Machines guy? I do. Forget it.
Hey, see?
There were 12 people.
Right.
And he's two were in the YouTube comments. Uh-huh. So there's 10 others who knew my reference the other day. What else you got, Sam?
I like your offensive line question. You know, on this podcast, we probably not place overemphasis on it, but place a lot more emphasis on offensive lines than, you know, other places. But how much does that factor into what you're looking at in terms of fantasy stuff? Like, how much are you looking at how prohibitively terrible an offensive line is when you're focusing on wide receiver production, running back production, even quarterback production?
Yeah. Quarterbacks, I'd say it matters the most. If you're on your back, can't throw the ball. We've all seen the Joe Burrow meme with that going on. Running
it's
back
been updated. Have you seen the new
yes,
one?
Yes, yeah. Now what's it's going off Chase. It's
the updated one is the ball going to Jamar Chase and then hitting the ground, and then the Penei Sewell blocking and even getting killed anyway.
It matters. Obviously, matters for running backs though. But it's like we talk about. You know, what it matters is our ability to kind of discern how much it matters worth putting into the process. Because what I see a lot of people do is they hold it against some running backs and not others. Joe Mixon, PFF's 25th ranked offensive line. We hear all about that. Najee, 31st ranked. No one seems to care that Christian McCaffrey has the 30th ranked or Dalvin Cook has the 27th ranked, Saquon Barkley at 32nd, because volume just wins out. Last year, top five PFF offensive lines in run blocking grade produced four top 24 PPR backs. The bottom five offensive lines also produced four top 24 backs. Now, the bottom ones had guys like Myles Gaskin, Austin Eckler, the pass catchers. That's how these guys win. Because fantasy football, weird game, we reward, you know, if you just look historically, targets are worth about 2.7 times more than a rush attempt. So that's how guys make up for it. That's why we shouldn't care about it for CMC. And it's also why we shouldn't care for Mixon and Najee, because they're getting the targets as well. So someone like Chubb, someone like, Jonathan Taylor, where they're not going to have the same sort of receiving role, I'm fine baking it more into that process. Even then, though, it's more of a tiebreaker for me. I mean, Ezekiel Elliott had an amazing offensive line going into last year. By week two, all of a sudden, it was a bottom unit in the league. So if we could accurately and confidently predict how good every O-line was going to be before the year, of course we go into it. But I think the volume wins out, and then our just ability to always predict it right, I think, is also too faulty to put too much stock behind it.
Yeah, because if I was going to use it, the Jonathan Taylor, Nick Chubb example are the ones. I mean, the Browns have our top graded offensive line, our top ranked. Jonathan Taylor's number two. It's also important to differentiate between run blocking and pass blocking, right? Like, the Titans had a mid-level offensive line last year, but they were really high in our run blocking grades, really low from a pass blocking standpoint. But yeah, Chubb and Taylor are the two guys that just come to mind as benefiting from the system plus the line being a volume guy. But your point about targets being valued that much more is,
yeah, they, an interesting one. It would almost be like they would be guys to shy away from if you knew they were running behind a bad offensive line. So if one of Taylor or Chubb was coming into the season, instead of their offensive line being in the top five, they were one of the worst lines in the NFL. Like, those would be the guys to scare away from because they're not going to make it up in the pass game. They're not factors there. Yeah. And if the line is that bad, like, it's not going to get better during the course of the year, but it could get worse.
That's why, so, I like half point perception more. To me,
that's what I was going to ask.
That makes more sense. Because full point, like Nick Chubb, everyone would name this dude as a top five real life running back. He's never finished better than eighth in fantasy. Wow. And that's, you know, not cool with me. But it's, again, it's the game we play. I mentioned the running quarterbacks. Aaron Rodgers, either the best or second best quarterback in the league last year. Fantasy tells us he was the fourth best. So,
how much volume? Like, how tough is it to square that in your brain? The idea that, you know, certainly some games in fantasy are so sort of far divorced from, like, you know, quote unquote real football. So you're looking for different things, right? You're not looking for the best players. You're looking for the guys that are going to game the system the best, the guys that just get rewarded most efficiently in the game. Because that's always been like a thing that I've kind of battled with in terms of just personally with fantasy. It's like, I don't know that I want to be chasing those guys versus just who the best players are.
Yeah. It comes down to volume. It's chase volume over talent, particularly at running backs. For wide receivers, tight ends, that's where, you know, all those targets is a little more volatile anyway, with just, you know, you can't just hand it to the guy. So in those cases, I'm more okay trying to chase the great player, the great talent. But with these running backs, like, you know, Kareem Hunt is probably a top 10 running back in the league. But if you draft him as a top 10 back in fantasy, you're going to miss out because he's just not used that way.
Right.
I think it's funny that a lot of the fantasy community is you know, aware of the concept of running backs are overrated and various things like that. But then, of course, you have to spend most of your time evaluating running backs, right? So there is clearly a distinction between NFL team building and fantasy team building.
Yeah, there's something funny about, like, the more that the sort of analytics world and general awareness has pointed towards running backs matter less and less and less and less, fantasy is almost in the opposite direction. It's like running backs have never been more important, particularly as the fewer of them are sort of true every down bell cow kind of running backs. Like, those guys are the most critical thing in the league. It's just funny that the way they're heading in complete opposite directions.
We're doing the draft show here, and, you know, Steve and Chris and Mike and all these guys are on the main stage, and Steelers draft Najee Harris, and just groans from everyone. What are they doing? Like, let's kick it over to Ian. I'm just ecstatic. Like, let's go. We got another three down workhorse here. Great day to be great.
Yeah, it's like a funeral going on the main set and over there in fantasy
popping
land.
The champagne.
Right. Ian's got the party poppers going.
But that's a big part of it, right? Najee's going to a place where from the top down, they're like, we got to run the ball better. And we got to run the ball better to the point that we're willing to draft a running back in the first round. To your point, he can catch the ball. Yeah. So when we are doing our evaluations on running backs, I mean, Najee looks good catching the ball. We saw it the other night, 45-yarder or whatever it was, just on a little check down, right? I mean, guys that can turn a check down from 6 yards into 40-plus yards, there's value there. And I also think the Steelers offense, from what I've seen, there's a difference in how running backs get targets, right? There are schemed up targets. There are screens and, you know, design swings and various things like that. And then there's check down heavy offenses. The year Matt Forte, remember Forte had like 100 catches that one year?
Yeah.
And he was like fantasy genius. But he wasn't a good running back. It was just an offense where he posted up 3 yards beyond the line of scrimmage and caught check downs. But it looks like the Steelers offense is going to be a little bit more check down heavy than it's been. And I think that does bode well for a guy like Najee, and especially in PPR leagues.
It is an interesting point, though, but, like, you don't want your offense, I think, to be looking at the running back first. If he's there as your third, fourth read, that's great. But I remember looking at some first read numbers with Teddy Bridgewater with and without McCaffrey, and we kind of saw the efficiency go up. And I think Justin Herbert was struggling with that when Eckler came back as well. So, yeah, fantasy will take those checkdowns all day long. Certainly not best for your real-life offenses, though.
That's one of the big sort of conundrums in dealing with a player like Christian McCaffrey, right? He's unquestionably one of the most talented football players at any position in the NFL. But how do you maximize that? Because if you do start doing what you're talking about, which is start figuring out a way where he becomes the designed target in this on this play, it's just automatically a less efficient way of moving the ball in offense. So when you start to do that, when you start to lean into that and sort of try and justify or maximize what you get out of this guy who's an incredible player, it hurts. Like, it actually makes the offense worse overall. And I don't think teams have figured that out yet. Like, if we get a guy like McCaffrey how are we supposed to best use him? Because it feels like a waste to just say, you know, you're a regular running back, you'll catch some checkdowns and you'll do better with them than, you know, Gio Bernard does, right? But it's also clearly not the way to do it to say, well, let's start running the offense through this guy as a focal point, because all the data says that actually makes the offense less efficient. So I think teams are still struggling with, like, what the hell that looks like. How are we supposed to make use of a guy like him?
How much do you look at coordinators and play calling history and strategy, whether it's, oh, they target tight ends a ton? I mean, so how much is that driven by personnel? Like, so Cam Newton targeted tight ends less than any quarterback in the league last year, right? So you would never look at the Patriots and say, well, they just don't value tight ends. Of course, I mean, they just broke the bank for two of them.
Right.
They had the worst tight end situation in the league last year, and that's saying a lot because there's a lot of bad tight end situations around there. So how much do you look at play callers and trends and history when it comes to how they distribute touches?
Piece of the puzzle, like anything, I'd be careful about putting too much weight on it. Mistake I made last year was with Darren Waller. I had him like tight end 4. It wasn't like I was fading the guy completely, but they had brought him Witten, which made no sense to me. They had Moreau, who was very solid in his rookie year. And I was just looking at some of Gruden's Raider teams, and we had, you know, Antonio Bryant, Clayton with those Buccaneers. Like, he was feeding Joe Vicious for 1 year, just some throwback names. These guys are getting fed targets. They draft Ruggs, they draft Edwards. And I was like, okay, I think Gruden wants to run this passing game through the wide receiver like he always did. I didn't think, which I should have, hey, maybe Gruden's just never had a tight end as good as Darren Waller. And I think that's what we see a lot of these times. So just looking at the base offense, we can find some value though when people, I think, don't look at the bigger picture, like Kyle Shanahan and Andy Reid. These guys have had amazing RB1s in fantasy for the better part of the past 2 decades, particularly for Reed. In the last 2-3 years, though, it's been more of a committee system, and that has allowed guys like Raheem Mostert and Trey Sermon to now be priced outside the top 30 running backs, when in past years, I mean, like, Matt Breida was a top 24 back in preseason last year. Like, people have just always been trying to catch up to the Devontae Freeman, the Alfred Morris, those, in Reed's case, you know, the Shady McCoy, the Brian Westbrook, all these past guys. But when they get burned for a few years, they kind of forget that's the ceiling. So now that we can get Clyde Edwards-Helaire, Raheem Mostert, Trey Sermon closer to the floor that we've seen historically from these running backs as opposed to the ceiling, that's when I'm buying and using that information.
Is that a product with Shanahan in particular of just like trying to figure out which guy is going to be that? Because the problem with the Shanahan offense the last few years is that anybody you plug into it is successful, and with injuries and all those kinds of things, it's been identifying which guy is going to get the boost and take off because of the offense.
Injuries have been the major part, but even with that, like, Matt Breida in 2018 was their highest scoring back. He finished as the RB26. Next year, Mostert, RB26. Jeff Wilson last year, RB31. And that's exactly where all the running backs are being drafted right now. So maybe that continues. Wouldn't be great, but we're not getting killed on the value. Or maybe Mostert and Sermon get featured and we start seeing Devontae Freeman, Tevin Coleman 2.0. So just, you know, yeah, consider the wide range of outcomes. I get why their value is lower. It shouldn't be in the top 20, but I'll take advantage of it when it is as low as it is.
How do you handle quarterbacks for receivers? Again, I think the general football trend is to say, well, this quarterback's bad, or say Allen Robinson he's had a terrible quarterback situation. But there's a difference between a guy like, even the worst quarterbacks aren't missing half their throws.
Yeah.
So you have, like, how do you take just quarterback aggressiveness? So, like, a Ryan Fitzpatrick in Washington, he's not the best quarterback in the league. He's a middle tier type of quarterback, but he's an aggressive downfield thrower. Or versus Teddy Bridgewater in Denver, who, if he starts, is he going to maximize a Cortland Sutton, a Jerry Jeudy? So how do you factor in quarterback, and what are you looking for from a fantasy standpoint as far as the quarterback situation for receivers?
As good as possible, man. That's why we're still sipping the Mecole Hardman Kool-Aid despite every, you know, practice route telling us otherwise, because when you can get Mahomes potential wide receiver 2, might be worth it. I would just say, you know, in best ball, we always want to stack these guys. Again, just best possible scenario. Stack your quarterback with multiple receivers. Historically, we've seen those lineups rise to the top. Fitzpatrick's specifically, my goodness, the amount of number 2 contracts that dude has gotten, Stevie, Marshall, Devontae, it's incredible. And through it all, I had stat. It's like he's had 7 or 10 years where he's had at least 10 starts, and the least amount of targets his wide receiver one has had is like 128. So Terry McLaurin, I think, is absolutely going to get fed. You mentioned, one of you guys mentioned earlier, like Parker, when he had yellow ball god right. fits, could make that happen. So it's, you know, it's a situation where I don't think there's a one-all, be-all answer to it. But yeah, it's just trying to figure out how the pieces fit to the best of our ability. And also just not falling, you know, prey to some of these easy storyline. Sam, I know you've been a vocal supporter alongside me that no, the Browns are not better off without Odell freaking Beckham. So realizing that, hey, even though they haven't meshed, we've still seen Baker operate at an incredibly high level twice in his career. And if we can get the best version of both those players, luck the hell out.
Yeah, let's talk about the Browns for a second for that reason. Like, Odell Beckham hasn't worked yet within this offense. The first year, they just weren't on the same page. They were constantly, like, Odell would run one route and Baker would try and hit another. And they, for the entire season, they just couldn't seem to get that straightened out. And then last year, you know, Odell was certainly better than the first year. They seemed to be on the same page more, but it just wasn't working as well as we think it should. Then Odell goes down, and that's more or less the same time when that offense started to get everything together and didn't have to face, you know, the Ravens and the Steelers for a while.
Yeah.
And we're able to kind of go on this run. Now we're going into this year when everything looks like it's in place, right? They've brought everybody back. The offensive line is still one of the best in the NFL. The system has had time to bed in. They understand what they're doing now. Even if they face the Ravens and the Steelers, I mean, we saw what they did to the Steelers in the playoffs. They seem better positioned now to be able to have this thing function against everybody, and they're getting Odell Beckham back, who, you know, he's, for all the injuries he's worked through, they don't feel like they should have had like a permanently debilitating effect on him.
Yeah.
So are we expecting the Browns overall, Baker Mayfield and Odell, like all of these guys, to just go through the roof?
Yeah, I think I am. I mean, I'm well ahead consensus on both Baker and OBJ. I don't think enough credit is given to, maybe credit's not the right word, but this is a guy going on his third offensive system last year. No preseason. COVID's out the window. Like, yeah, it's not surprising that he started a little bit slow. And you mentioned the Ravens and Steelers games. Look at the other games. 35 points, 34, 49, 32. It's not like Beckham was the one single-handedly holding back this offense. So the one cool stat I found in the situation, I just looked at what quarterbacks do without their wide receiver ones. Spoiler, Matt Ryan without Julio, not looking good. But what I found was Patrick Mahomes without Tyreek Hill, and it's actually been a decent like 8-game sample size, Patrick Mahomes averages 0.6 more yards per attempt with Tyreek Hill sidelined. Now, would anyone ever try to make the argument the Chiefs are better off with Tyreek Hill? No! So don't do it with Odell freaking Beckham on the Browns as well. But yeah, for me, I'm taking Beckham ahead of those Bengals receivers as the wide receiver. He's wide receiver 20 in my ranks. He was wide receiver 19 before he got hurt. This is a guy that was top 5 his entire Giants tenure, and I'm not saying he'll get back to that, but people are so scared off these last 2 years, he's going outside the top 30.
Like, at the minimum, pretty much everybody should expect him to be better than last year
when he
was there, right? Like, even if you, again, even if you don't think he's going to get anywhere near that Giants thing, he's not going to be worse than it was last season because everything else around him is better.
He was being priced like he was going to get back the Giants his first and his second year, and now he's not. And it's the same thing with Baker, man. Like, he, last year, they had that weird weather stretch, the Raiders, the Texans, the Eagles games, just no snap volume.
So I'm a big weather guy.
Yeah.
I am a big weather and dome guy. I think it just gets ignored far too often. And so now that I'm a Josh Allen apologist officially.
Yeah. We're not
Let me just make the statement. Josh Allen, from a statistical and evaluation standpoint, playing in Buffalo is working from behind. I mean, because you're talking in a 16 and now 17 game schedule, if you do have 3 or 4 weather games, it's a quarter of your schedule. It's a little bit less now. But if it's a quarter of your schedule where you're dealing with wind is just as bad as rain and snow, right? If you're dealing with that, of course it's going to have an impact on things. So Josh Allen might be working at a deficit compared to other quarterbacks. And I truly believe, you know, if you're in December and you don't have to deal with that and you're in a dome and it's a significant difference.
Yeah. That's why the Baker Mayfield season last year, the amount of games you could actually take anything from was so small. That's why I think genuinely it's part of the reason that the Browns are kind of dragging their heels on this contract extension, because when you look at what, like, I was saying going into the season that, look, week one is the worst possible start for them because all the things, COVID, no preseason, new system, new, you know, everything. And you're facing the Ravens, who blitz more than anybody else, who are creative with it, understand like what you're trying to do when they blitz and put a guy in the way. So Baker has like an absolute disaster and everything is a train wreck, right? Then you can't take anything from the Bengals games because they were the Bengals, right? So it's like, oh, we got back on track. It's like, well, of course you did. You faced the Bengals. Then you faced the Steelers, who are arguably the best defense in the NFL. Again, can't really take anything from that. You would expect that to win. And then you have that stretch of bad weather games. It's like, well, now there's weather. You can't really take anything from those games because those are weird weather games. So you end up with this run of like three games where you can glean any information whatsoever about Baker Mayfield and the Browns offense.
My concern about the OBJ stuff, and maybe it's too anecdotal, but my concern is the way they were not on the same page in 2019. It was pretty consistent. It was bad. And I know the whole Browns offense was bad. And then the anecdotal evidence, which is like, I remember the time, and this is where Stafford loses Calvin Johnson, right? Yeah. But you also remember that the way Stafford played with Calvin Johnson was like, I have Calvin Johnson. I'm going to feed him. Deshaun Watson's reliance on DeAndre Hopkins early in his career. There were pass concepts where DeAndre Hopkins had no business getting the ball and he still got the ball. It's like the route versus the coverage doesn't make any sense and Watson was still going there. But when Stafford lost Calvin Johnson, he was better at times, but his production didn't change. And then Watson lost DeAndre Hopkins and they had a better rounded receiving core and Watson had his best season. So that is my argument against OBJ helping the Browns. That is my argument for maybe he would hold them back, because I've seen elements of Baker feeding OBJ targets, them not being on the same page, and I saw this element of Baker adjusting to the offense with a lesser supporting cast and playing better. That's where I'm bringing hesitancy to the table, even though overall I would say, okay, they should figure out a way to get OBJ into this offense and make the most of it.
Well, we want the best of both worlds, right? I think it was after Beckham got hurt, Baker, only Aaron Rodgers graded higher when targeting his first read. When he knows where he's going with the ball, like, he's fantastic. Let's get an actual coverage shifter like Beckham out there instead of Higgins, Donovan Peoples. I mean, they're fine receivers in their own right, but, you know, we're moving towards like a let's surround quarterbacks with bad receivers argument. So they can just play within the confines. Let's get Baker with the best version of OBJ going through his reads. I think we'll see something special. I do want to say, though, it's not so much fantasy related, but I'm kind of noticing this trend here with the 2018 Browns, 2019 Cardinals, 2020 Bengals. Each got their 101 quarterback. First year, maybe some promise. Second year, OBJ the Browns. Hopkins the Cardinals. Bengals draft Chase. A lot of hype comes in. Maybe, you know, oversell some other roster holes going on. Post-type Browns in 2020, as we saw, defense and O-line were a lot better. I wonder if the 2021 Cardinals are ready to really make that jump because they've, again,
you're too hype. So it takes 2 years for the hype to kick in.
Second year hype, third year post-hype, I think is where they go nuts. So I'm not sure what the fourth year is going to be for the Browns.
And it's also because, like, the third year, you're coming off, like, the disappointment, right? Yeah. Because the Browns, obviously everything fell apart, everyone got fired, and now the only way to go is up. But for the Cardinals, everyone is so down on them because of the way that season ended. Yeah. But if you actually just look at the overall, it's where they should be. Like, if you reversed a year and went, what's the Cardinals' record going to be this year? What is Kyler Murray going to look like at the end of this year? Like, all the things, it's basically exactly where it should have been. The problem is they started off hot. They beat a couple of good teams that they weren't expected to. And now expectations have gone through the roof and they failed to meet those expectations. So everyone is sort of treating this like, oh, this is just not working. Like, now Cliff's under pressure and Kyler's under pressure and they got to show something. Otherwise, we're going to blow this whole thing up. But realistically, we should probably be looking at this and saying, it's pretty much on track. Okay, if they don't still go forward, sure, it's still an issue. But like, the arrow is probably still pointing up for the Cardinals, even if it finished on a down note.
I like it. I'm all in on the Cardinals. Convinced.
All in. Wow.
Now, I mean, the trouble with the Cardinals, by the way, I'm a big believer in the hype comes a year later, right? Basically what you're saying, right, is, you know, the Browns were hyped up 2 years ago and big disappointment.
Post-hype bounce back.
Yes, post-hype bounce back. The problem with the Cardinals is, man, they on paper look like the worst team in the NFC West, which is really – but they're good. I mean, the Cardinals are good. They might be the seventh or eighth best team in the NFC and the fourth best team in the NFC West. Just throwing random numbers out there, but it might be close.
It's a juggernaut of a division.
So they're going to beat each other up.
Yeah, that's going to be tough.
Let's wrap it up quickly with a Kyler Murray, because you're talking about the Cardinals and his rushing value. How much did you see his value increase last year because they started to tap into him in the design running game? And remember, there's a difference between design runs and scrambles, and the Cardinals, I think, realized Kyler can be a weapon in the design game last year.
Number one fantasy quarterback ever was in fantasy points per game was 2019 Lamar Jackson.
Right.
Shouldn't surprise many people. Kyler, before he got his shoulder banged up last year, was on pace to beat what Lamar had brought to the table. That's how effective and good he was. And once he really had that injury, I equated it at the time. I got ripped by some real football people that didn't realize I was talking fantasy. But it was like when Taysom Hill came under center and stopped throwing it to Alvin Kamara. You take away Alvin's receiving ability, you take away Kyler's legs, they're shelved themselves in terms of what they bring to the table as a fantasy player. The question with Kyler is the guy telling the truth when he says that he wants to rely on his legs less moving forward? Lamar Jackson said the same thing last year. It held true until the bye week when they saw what that version of the offense looked like, and he got back to running pretty quickly. So Kyler for me is my QB4. You'd be hard pressed to find anyone having him lower than fifth. I still think Mahomes, Lamar, Josh Allen give you a little bit more upside, but Kyler is right there. I mean, if he finishes 101 at a QB, nobody's going to be particularly surprised.
There's also for as much as those quarterbacks always make noises like that, hey, we want to lean more, I want to go away from that or lean more on my arm and all those kinds of things. Like when they say that, they're talking about scrambles, not the design run part of it. Like they're not saying, oh, we went way too heavy using me in the run game. We got to go back and, rely on the pass game and our running backs. They're saying, there's a couple of plays I took off when I shouldn't have, right? And we want to be able to make that pass play. But with what makes Lamar and Cam Newton and Kyler Murray and those guys so special is that design run game. It's not, the fact that they can scramble is great, but that's not what we're talking about here.
And that's where Jalen Hurts is going to come in. Jalen Hurts is a good designed runner. Josh Allen is rarely used as a design runner. He's an outstanding scrambler, and that's why he keeps rushing for 8+ touchdowns a year, because my prediction on Allen was that he would be one of those guys that is a good fantasy quarterback, would put up a bunch of touchdowns, but would never achieve the level of efficiency that he did last year. So missed on that at the moment, which is why we signed the apology for him. But I always thought Allen would be that perfect guy that would put up, throw for 26 touchdowns, run for 8 more, whatever it is, but, complete 58% of his passes and turn it over a bunch. But who cares about turnovers, right, from a fantasy standpoint?
Right.
But, his efficiency was incredible last year, and he didn't lose the rushing ability or the big play ability.
That's why the new hot topic and in running back Bills land, now that they have 258 million reasons to maybe protect them a little bit more, will we chill out near the goal line and get Zach Moss some touches? We'll see.
Yeah, get Zach Moss the ball. Well, Ian, thanks for stopping by. Tell everybody where they can read all your work and everything you're working on right now.
Good time, guys. Thanks for promoting me to big leagues for a day. Yeah, PFF Fantasy Football Podcast at PFF.com. Had 100 articles in 100 days series just wrap up last week. So anything you want to know about fantasy should be on that. Also just had preseason week 2 takeaways published. You can hear myself and Dwayne McFarland talk about that on the Wednesday edition. Some good pods coming up. None other than Nico Collins will be appearing on the Friday edition. So looking forward to seeing how Houston Texans training camp has been going from his point of view.
I want to add my Texans theory to tomorrow's show, the Thursday show.
Okay.
Because I think it might be happening in the next couple. Ooh. I think it might be happening. Maybe Nick Caserio is a secret genius. We will see. Anyway, so this is our new Wednesday show. Somebody asked in the YouTube comments, they want times, right? We've got pretty standard times that we're going to be working with here. 7 a.m. on Mondays, we'll be live. 10:30 on Thursdays, we'll do that tomorrow. And then Wednesday, as of now, I think we're aiming for 2:00, all Eastern time.
Two? I thought it was one.
Or is it one? It's sometime on. We'll get the Wednesday one. This is why we're talking it out here, live on the show. We'll get you a time for Wednesday. It's still a work in progress. But if you're listening to the podcast, you're getting 3 shows a week. You're not getting 3 a day like you get with Ian, but you're getting 3 per week over here now with the PFF NFL podcast. So thanks to everybody for tuning in. Thanks to Ian, and we'll see you guys tomorrow.